to Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 2007 Brad Bird film Ratatouille. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
Doing great.
Barrett, I have a bunch of personal history questions that I want to ask you, but let's just start with what your history with this film was. I'm curious, were you watching Pixar movies in 2007? Is this something you came across later?
Yeah, I was definitely watching Pixar films in 2007. I don't know if I've mentioned on the podcast or not in the past, Sam, that my kind of introduction to Pixar was, you know, 95 when the original Toy Story came out. And our family, with another family, was supposed to serve a Thanksgiving meal at a downtown Salvation Army site. And they didn't need us. They had too many volunteers, so they turned us away. So we had nothing else to do with ourselves. We went to a movie. So we went to see Toy Story. So I was hooked on Pixar from then on. So from that point on till probably about Ratatouille, I think I probably saw them all when they came out in the theater.
Yeah, I mean, this is about 12 years into Pixar's kind of miracle run. This is the eighth film. So Toy Story, Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, Incredibles, Cars, Ratatouille in 2007, then Wall-E, Up, Toy Story 3. That's sort of the 12, the 15-year run where they make 10 movies, and by and large, those are pretty unassailable, and many of them kind of animation masterpieces. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I was trying to think yesterday as I was preparing this, what's the first Pixar movie I saw? Because for me, 1995 was my first year of college, and I wasn't going to a lot of movies because you had to pay to go to movies. And I also was just busy being a college student. So I know I didn't see Toy Story for a long time. I know I didn't see A Bug's Life. I know I didn't see Toy Story 2. So I'm not sure when I started watching these. By 2007, my son actually, his second birthday was the day that Ratatouille opened. I don't think we definitely didn't go see that in the theater. His first movie in a theater was Wall-E the next year. Mm-hmm. But we were definitely by 2007 or eight, at this point, kind of absorbing Pixar movies through our kids. So I definitely saw this probably by 2008. I remember listening to a friend who was a chef and had kids talk about this movie, and he was kind of blown away by like how well done it was. It's fun to listen to food people talk about this movie, because as somebody who's not, I've never worked in a restaurant, like I believe this seems realistic. I mean, not obviously a rat cooking, but like the structure of the kitchen and all the food stuff in this film. But hearing people who live in that world, they definitely point to this as like a very accurate portrayal of that.
Well, I have worked in a restaurant. I've worked in a couple different restaurants, both in the kitchen and serving and waiting and busing. And so I have to tell you my personal connection to Ratatouille in that respect. Amy and I were, my wife and I, at the time, my fiance, we were working in a kitchen in Brunswick, Maine, and one of the wait staff, it was not a kitchen to hire particularly well-prepared servers. Basically, would hire any warm bodies, and then the German chef would abuse us all verbally and even sometimes physically. He was known to throw knives at people. Anyway, one day we were serving Ratatouille, and one of the other servers, who was very inexperienced in the world of food, asked us what the special was that day, and I told him it was Ratatouille, just messing with his head. And then I overheard him telling the table as he was explaining the lunch special, he says, "Then we have Ratatouille." So that's always been my connection to the dish. Although, if you're going to ask, I've actually never prepared Ratatouille, but I was thinking about it this morning.
Have you eaten it? I presume if you were serving it.
Yeah, I've eaten it, but I've never, and partly because my wife is not a fan of eggplant. So if it's eggplant, I'm on my own. But I was just thinking this morning, you know, I should pick up an eggplant and try making a ratatouille and see if I do it the right way, if it comes out.
Right. I will, since we're telling personal stories, I will tell you, although I didn't see Pixar movies until the mid-2000s, my history with Pixar goes back way before Toy Story. My aunt is a screenwriter, And she, sometime in the late 80s or very early 90s, did some work for this company called Pixar. And I, when she came to back to Minnesota, she brought me a poster. So in my childhood, like, basement, the room I spent most of my time in, throughout my childhood, I had this big, like, computer-generated image Pixar poster. And I remember in 95 when Toy Story came out, thinking, oh, that little company made a movie. That's cool. Because like, I just had, it was just a name that I knew, and I saw that poster every day in my childhood. So it was very funny to when that happened, and then now to look back and think, like, wow, that's kind of crazy. So she, I mean, she, like I said, it was probably 88, 89 or 90. So it's a name I was very familiar with. A couple other just your history with questions. What is your history with Paris? This is a very, a movie set in Paris, a movie that is in love with a version of Paris, I think.
I've been to Paris twice. My first time was 1993 when my wife and I were leading a semester-long study abroad trip for the English department, and we ended up at Paris at the end of the trip. So this was December. The crossing from England, this is before the Channel. So we came over on a coach on the ferry, and we landed in France in a classic fog, thick as pea soup. We had a Scottish bus driver who was incredibly nervous about driving in Paris anyway. And doing this in the fog, long story short, by the time we got to the hotel, it was 10:30 at night. Tempers were extraordinarily frayed. And the reason I bring all that up is it kind of kicked us off to, it wasn't exactly a charming visit. It was cold. It was rainy. I couldn't see why people fell in love with Paris. Plus, I had a 6 and an 8-year-old. We left Paris in a sleet storm that almost shut all the rails down. Missed our train to Prague. I mean, all kinds of bad stuff happened in Paris. Second time, 2010, I went with a Bethel colleague to co-lead one of our trips abroad in January. And even though it was January, the weather was quite mild, and it was a much more delightful experience, I would say. I ate a lot of crepes. I committed a terrible faux pas. I went into a cafe after 6 o'clock and asked for a cappuccino after 6 o'clock at night. Of course, I was sneered at because you don't have cappuccinos after noon. But anyway, that was a pretty delightful visit.
Well, I'm glad that story turned around. I've been to Paris probably 7 or 8 times. It's I think my favorite city in the world. So that's part of this movie for me is, you know, it is a fantasy version of Paris, but it's they recreate the feeling of being in Paris pretty well. And I definitely love that. This is a film directed by Brad Bird. I'm curious, are you familiar with Bird as a filmmaker? I mean, he made just his filmography is pretty short, so I'll just run through this. He made The Iron Giant in 1999, The Incredibles in 2004, and then Ratatouille. Then he does 2 live action films, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Tomorrowland, and then does Incredibles 2. I'm curious, like, what your experience with Brad Bird is, because this seems to be a very Brad Bird film.
Yeah, I've seen most of those. I like The Iron Giant a lot. I think The Iron Giant was a little underrated. The first Incredibles is incredible. I couldn't watch the second Incredibles. I turned it off after half an hour. But yeah, so I think the first part of his career is the stronger part, and that's the part I actually quite admire. He's, you know, as you were saying earlier, how great the film looks. I mean, his attention to detail, kind of his authenticity, his ability to avoid a lot of the cliche traps of animated films. You know, a lot of the reviews of the film mention that, like, he doesn't do a lot of the shtick that you kind of expect from animated films. So I think he's a fine craftsman in that respect.
It's interesting to now. I will say I've only seen this and The Incredibles. I've never seen The Iron Giant, although I know a lot about it. I've read a lot about it. I've heard podcasts where people talk about it. So it seems like both this and The Iron Giant are thematically related, at least in terms of sort of the idea of a character which appears to be one thing, you know, a rat or a giant weapon, basically, but at its core is something else. And then it's sort of asking this question of like, is the world capable of seeing this thing for what it really is, or is it only going to see it in terms of externals? Is that an accurate read of kind of the heart of the Iron Giant?
I think so, but I think also, as is Ratatouille, I think there's a sense of not only the heart of what something really is, but the process of discovering or identifying exactly what that identity is. So I think that's very much part of, to me, that's one of the arcs in Ratatouille is Remy. Remy is really trying to redefine himself, and he doesn't want to be a rat, but he's not exactly a human. And so he's got to figure out, what does it mean to be the Remy that I am that's still true? You know, this is a film that in many ways it reminded me a little bit of Gattaca, a little bit of this notion of is your biology your destiny? And also, this film is following on our watching of Barry Lyndon, is your identity where society puts you? I think maybe I'm stretching a point a bit, but I think there are some thematic connections between those two movies as we think about that, because they're both about challenging stereotypes, setting goals for yourself, or trying to overcome the obstacles that society has placed in front of you.
Oh, I definitely thought about that as I was thinking about this movie, because this is asking like, are you born with an essential nature? And can you defy that nature or change that nature? Because as you point out, that's the central. I love that there's sort of multiple movies in this movie. Like there is this movie that is Remy and his father, and sort of sorting out like, you're a rat. This is what rats do. So there's the whole question about like, is it okay to steal? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, we're thieves. This is what we do. But Remy has this tension with that at the beginning, and then later in the movie that becomes the issue in terms of his relationship with Linguini, is like, okay, they have this deal that he's not going to do this, but then he starts to do it because of kind of his falling out with them. So I mean, Remy says early on to his father, you know, I'm tired of taking, I want to make things, I want to add something to this world.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad says, later on when they're looking at the rat traps and the exterminator says, this is the way things are. You can't change nature. And Remy says, change is nature, the parts we can influence. And it starts when we decide.
Mm-hmm.
So that's such an obvious like theme in there. And what I realized was I had never thought about this movie, because I don't think about Remy having an age because he's a rat. So like, I don't think like, well, Remy's sort of the equivalent of a teenager or a 20-year. I don't think about it that way, but it's like, oh, this actually structurally Remy's story is kind of a coming of age story of him. Like, this is about him and his relationship to his father, relationship to his family, and what it looks like to push out into the world and kind of define yourself and define your identity in relationship to what you grew up, kind of where you grew up and how you grew up. And I mean, it really does have that, that sense to it.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the idea that his identity as a rat is, you know, biologically determined. Well, his special gift, right? His gift of taste and smell, that's also part of his biology. So he may be a rat, but he's also a rat that's been given these particular gifts. So, you know, we can define biology very narrowly, and that's exactly, you know, so there's a sense in which the film is also expanding that. Well, you may be a rat, but maybe there's more on the spectrum of being a rat than you're actually taking into account.
Right. And you know, to your point, Remy talks about taking on different identities. Like there's later in the film when he's stuck in the rat trap and he's talking to his projection of Gusto. I mean, he just says plainly, I'm sick of pretending. I pretend to be a rat for my father. I pretend to be a human for Linguini. I pretend you exist so I can have someone to talk to. You only tell me what stuff I already know. I know who I am. Why do you need to tell me? And then once he's escaped and he's running back to the restaurant and they ask why he cares. And I mean, this is his moment of like realization of, oh, I know who I am. I'm not a rat. I'm not a human. I'm a cook.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's like, so what is his nature? Well, his nature is to be in the kitchen. So what I realized was like, this movie has a lot more Lady Bird in it than I thought. Like it really
that's
is.
Right, that's
you know,
right.
I kept thinking about that. And it's like, there are things Remy says to his father or says to himself that I'm like, I could imagine Lady Bird McPherson saying a version of this to her mother, which obviously endeared me to this movie more, because like that's one of my favorite things. Now, one of the big differences between, say, this and a Lady Bird is that Lady Bird is not overtly exceptional. That's kind of the point of that movie, is it's not a coming of age story about somebody who is, she very well may be exceptional and may be gifted, but we don't necessarily see it in that, where Remy, as you point out, like really has a special gift. He is different. I mean, he is kind of exceptional beyond exceptional. And this is a story about that as well, which seems to be another Brad Bird theme. In something like The Incredibles, that is a story about these, you know, superheroes who are not allowed to sort of use their exception of their, what makes them exceptional, and the tension about like, is this person with this gift allowed to be what they are? So that seemed like another Bird theme.
Well, it's interesting too, Sam, that he, by defining himself at the end as a cook and finding his identity as a cook, or a chef, you know, he both unites both elements of himself, that is the rat and the human. But he also, it's interesting, he ends up defining himself in terms of what he does. And he defines himself in terms of his role, and he defines himself in terms of relationships, because one of the key things, I mean, really about food in this film is it's not just film as a creative, the making of food is a creative act, which is important. This is also a film about the artist as a young rat, right? Finding himself as an artist. But what's important is he doesn't make food to please himself necessarily. He makes food as an act of it's an offering. It's a service. It's a way of taking all these ingredients that have potential, enabling them to realize their potential, but then giving them to others as a kind of gift. You know, we'll come back to the end of the film and talk about his relationship with Anton Ego. But that's really at the heart of this film. It's about what happens when people taste this thing that you've made. And I have to say, as somebody who enjoys making food for people, you know, one of the things I do is I make ice cream for people's birthdays in my office suite. I do it because I love it when people say, "Oh, thank you for the ice cream. It was so good." I mean, it's like there's something when you cook for people or you make food for people. It's this relationship you create, and there's a sense of deep satisfaction when somebody comes back and says, "Thanks, thank you. That was really good. I enjoyed that." And I think that's what Remy's trying to do.
Well, and I love that you, with the exception of the very beginning of the film when Remy's kind of discovering his gift, I don't think you almost never see him eat something.
Right. Right.
Like he tastes to the extent that it's about creating. You know, that's why I wanted to quote that line where he says, like, I'm tired of taking. I want to make something. I want to contribute something to this world. And that's the thing he points out. That's the thing that he says humans do. Humans build things. They make things. And it's like, I want to be this type of being, you know, who puts something out. I mean, I love at the end of the movie, the very, very end of the movie, when they're at the new restaurant, one of the features that's added to the restaurant is the little staircase for Remy to go up and look out the window into the dining room so he can watch people eat. So he can watch them actually. Because that's the part he's getting only from, you know, feedback from the restaurant staff or reviews, but he ceases to get to see that except for in the kitchen. So there is, I think that is a powerful thing. And it harkens back to my favorite food movie, which I also thought a lot about this, this week, which is Babette's Feast. Like that you don't see Babette eat, but there's that wonderful moment of her sitting, sipping wine in the kitchen, like having completed this thing. And so we're watching, you know, kind of through her eyes, these people take in this meal. It's not for her, but it's for her to give. It's her gift to give to the world. And that's sort of the same with Remy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the iconic image of the chef, isn't it? The chef presenting the food. I think about the cooking shows, right? And the contestants bring their food forward. They say, you know, what I've made for you today, chef, is. You're right. It's not about them eating the food. I mean, there's, you know, a good chef samples the food in process and make sure everything tastes okay. But at the end, it's ultimately for somebody else.
So what I like about this movie, you know, that since this is a movie about Remy being this sort of having this exceptional gift and his sort of discovery of it is the various levels of abilities or exceptionalism or lack of exceptionalism in this movie. So it's what's great about the character of Linguini is that he is, if you designed the most unexceptional person, they put him at the center of this movie, and he's not a problem to Remy. He's actually the thing that helps Remy to achieve his gift. But like, what if I'm thinking about like what does Linguini do well? And it's like, well, it turns out he roller skates pretty well. He's humble enough eventually to like just be the waiter, but like there's nothing about him. I mean, I love the moment when he and Remy are sort of making the deal and he says, "You know how to cook and I know how to appear to be human." I mean, like, he sets the bar pretty low for himself, you know. And so we have this this relationship, and it's not a relationship between people who are exceptional. It's also not a story about Remy teaching Linguini to be great. Linguini just sort of is fine the way he is, but Remy is something special. Gusteau seems to be another. There's very few people in this movie, I think, get to be at that level of exceptional. Gusteau seems to be there, but he's gone by the time the movie begins, right? He's only a figment of Remy's imagination and a ghost, you know, kind of around this movie. I love the scene where Gusteau is quizzing Remy about the roles of people in the kitchen, and they go, I mean, for one thing, it's a great introduction to to people watching the movie to say, okay, let me tell you who all it's exposition masked pretty well. It's like, let me tell you who everybody in this kitchen is, let me tell you what roles they play. And then they get down to Linguini as the garbage boy, and Remy's first response is, well, he's not important because he doesn't cook. And the Gusteau part of Remy stops him and says, oh, but he's part of the kitchen too, right? And you never know who can cook. And he's sort of saying that to Remy about Linguini, but also this is where Remy still feels on the outside of all of this. So he's saying it, it's sort of also indicating again that idea that you too could do this.
And I got to go down a little rabbit trail for a minute here, Sam, just to point out that the character of Gusteau, his full name, Auguste Gusteau, first of all, his first and last names are anagrams of each other. But as you probably know, he's based loosely on a historical figure that actually was a real life chef who committed suicide after his restaurant was rumored to be losing a star. Subsequently, the restaurant did lose the star. Whether or not that's why he committed suicide is kind of unclear. But Brad Bird and his team, they did a lot of research. They visited a lot of actual restaurants, and so they really kind of did know their stuff. They visited that particular restaurant, and then Colette, whom we haven't mentioned yet, she's based on a real life French chef who actually owns three restaurants, and her restaurant in London has the highest Michelin rating, which is 3 stars. So there's a lot of ways in which this film is an animated film, more so than many live action films, is very true to the world that it's depicting. So that goes along with what you're saying about this little very cleverly done montage, which is also an exposition that kind of gets us into the world of the kitchen.
Well, this is also the in line with other Pixar movies, which are not afraid to get very dark very early, though it's handled lightly, because when you watch that little like TV segment in the cold open to the movie, and it talks about Gusteau's death, I mean, it only so lightly implies, so he got this star and then he died, and you're like, well, he commits suicide, he drinks himself to death, something dark happens, and they just sort of the lightest touch on it and move away. And then the version of Gusteau that we see in the movie is not the ghost of Gusteau, but it is Gusteau as understood by Remy through reading his books. So it's like a kind of maybe super ego of Remy's creation, through the character of Gusteau, to the point where I love the joke when Remy finds out that Linguini is Gusteau's son, and the picture of Gusteau says, "I have a son." He's like, "How did you not know that?" Well, it's like, "I'm a figment of your imagination. I only know what you know." So there, you know, it sort of pulls back from that. To me, Colette is one of the really interesting characters, because she is somebody who seems special in that kitchen, right? She's not even the sous chef. Mm-hmm. But you know, she makes her speech kind of about why she's where she at. So there's a critique of kind of the patriarchal hierarchy of the restaurant world. So that's why it's interesting to hear about sort of who Colette is based on, because it's one that's the person that I'm interested in terms of, you know, who are the other people who may in fact be exceptional. Mm-hmm. You know, you wonder if Colette maybe is, and there are these systems around her. And as she goes around, the other great moment is when she's teaching Linguini, and she goes around and points out all of the other cooks. So it's the second time we get pointed to everybody, but instead of it being, here is their important role in the kitchen, it's here is their backstory and kind of the dark backstory of each person. So she's saying, like, the food world may seem snooty, but that doesn't mean that these are snooty people. But what's interesting is we also see Colette and these other cooks have a limit or a ceiling to them. And what we don't know is if that's real or self-imposed. Because when she's teaching Linguini Remy about the kitchen, she says, you know, I know Gusteau's style cold. I know his style. I know all of his recipes. And so first she says, you know, in every dish, he did something unexpected. And you see Linguini write down, do something unexpected. And she stops him and says, no, it's his job to be unexpected. It's our job to follow the recipe. So there is this sense of, like, again, I don't know if that's a self-imposed ceiling, if it's mm-hmm. a ceiling within their abilities or a ceiling put on them by the industry. But what's interesting is she says she knows Gusteau's style cold. But if we pay attention to Gusteau at the beginning of this movie, when Remy's watching him on TV, he talks about how the real chef has to be fearless and take risks and do these things. So it's like she, somewhere along the way, even in that kitchen, his real message has gotten lost, you know, and maybe that's the function of Skinner in this movie, right? To say, like, we're done creating. Now we're just following recipes, where that's the opposite of what Gusteau was saying.
Well, and Remy remembers that when he modifies that dish, right? He doesn't put the sauce on that Gusteau is called for. He makes a different sauce, and that actually rescues the dish. So in fact, Gusteau's that was one of Gusteau's flops, and Remy kind of rescues it with his own creativity, which Colette, you're right, does not recognize. I want to dwell on Colette for just a minute, because I think she represents two different poles in terms of how we think about the world of the kitchen of a Michelin star restaurant. On the one hand, you get the critique when she tells Linguini, haute cuisine is an antiquated hierarchy built upon rules written by stupid old men, rules designed to make it impossible for women to enter this world. And of course, that is famously true. It is very difficult for women to make it in that particular world because of some of the expectations and a lot of the sexism. Women do make it, but to a much smaller degree than men. So you've got, you know, again, you don't expect necessarily from an animated film a significant social critique, but there it is. But then you're right. On the other hand, you have an introduction to who are all these people in the kitchen, and it looks very much like a very egalitarian world where almost anyone can make it. In fact, I have to insert here, Sam. My wife and I started watching a Netflix series called Five Star Chef about these people that are trying out to be able to cook in a five-star London hotel. And one of the guys who's actually made it through to the next round has no formal training as a chef, spent 6 months sleeping outdoors because he was homeless. And yet this guy can cook. And that's all that it takes for him to be seriously in competition to cook in this world-class kitchen. So there's this really interesting kind of tension between a kind of elitism and egalitarianism at the same time.
Well, it's interesting because you realize Although this is a movie about, this exceptional, I almost want to say person, this exceptional being in Remy, and Gusteau, and maybe the potential of others, that it is also so necessarily collaborative. Like you're seeing, even when Remy is cooking through Linguini, it's not just him. You're seeing other people bringing things, doing things. You're seeing the whole machine of the kitchen go. And then when everybody leaves, you see the rats do it. You know, that again, I mean, that what a picture of collaboration that, to your point, these, other than Remy, none of these rats know anything about cooking, but he's like, under the right direction, under the right tutelage, like they make these, they make the restaurant work for that night. So it is about exceptionalism in the service, as we talked about before, of others, but also leading to this kind of collaboration.
I mean, Gusteau never says anyone can be a great cook. All he says is anyone can cook, and then maybe some of you do it really well. So it's a very egalitarian approach to food.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the line in that TV special is anyone can cook, but only the fearless can be great. So there is this sense of like, like everybody could, be part of this. Everybody sh and he's sort of saying everybody should cook, but he's also leaving space for this exceptional. And that's the part that gets missed until, maybe later in this movie we start to see that. What I find interesting about this film in terms of the arc or message of the movie is that it's not really about Remy teaching Linguini or the chefs or even the other rats about the importance of taking risks necessarily. It might be in there, but that's not the arc of the story. The arc of the story is not Linguini learns I need to be the person who is follows Gusteau's advice and is fearless and take risks. And it's not even clear necessarily if Colette learns that lesson. And unless you read the end of that movie, it's hard to know how the restaurant at the end of the movie is run. Colette clearly seems to be, along with Remy, like working really close alongside Remy. So there's a potential that you could say, well, she's actually just as she thought she was teaching Linguini, and really she was teaching Remy how to work in the kitchen, work within the world of the kitchen, that now he is teaching her, trying to pass along the real kind of the real stuff about being an artist, about, that it's not about the recipe, it's about being willing to take risks and about those things. But the film's not explicit about that message, which I find interesting.
Yeah, I don't I think the end I don't see a clear hierarchy at the end. I think what you get at the end is a clear kind of three-part collaboration. That's going on. So I think it's obviously about Remy's gifts, and I think it's about the three of them working together collaboratively.
Yeah, I just found that interesting as like you the message of this movie. This could be a movie about taking risks and about this, but that's not what this movie is necessarily at its core, which I'm not saying is a good thing or a bad thing. I find it interesting that it has this message about it, but it's like, but that's not exactly where we're going here. To your point, Gusteau says, not everyone or everyone can cook, but only the fearless can be great. Which also may be implying not everybody should be fearless, but some should be fearless, right? So you have a little bit of that. Another thing about this movie that I think is exceptional, and one of the things that's one of the takeaways that people talk about with this movie, is that this is such a great movie about experiencing food and experiencing art more broadly. I mean, the food looks great. This is in an era where Pixar just kept getting better and better and better at depicting characters, people, objects. But I mean, like if you look at the bread or any of the other ingredients, like it looks so fantastic. I can't watch this movie and not just want to go get some good bread and some good cheese, and like you want to taste things as you're watching this. And then it has various ways that it depicts people experiencing the food. I like that it doesn't land on one thing to say. Whenever somebody tastes something, we're going to go into this technique of expressing it. So you get the most simple version of this is you get Skinner when he tastes, I think it's when he tastes the soup that Remy makes, the first thing, and he's going into it, and his face is so angry, and even though he doesn't want to like the soup, like, you can't help but see his face sort of turn, and it's like, oh, it's good. You know, like so that's the very simple, where you're just seeing it on someone's face. But then there is maybe one of the best ones is when Remy is at the beginning, when he's starting to smell and taste, and it cuts to, like, the character just on a black backdrop, and you have the swirls of color and the sounds, and each thing he tastes or smells has something different. And then as he combines them, you're seeing those, like, that's the, I think the big magic trick of this movie is we can show you things, we can play sounds for you, but how do we convey what it feels like to taste a really good piece of cheese or a really good mushroom or a really good strawberry? And how do we convey to you that that's different? And how do we convey to you what it would be like to combine those? And I feel like they pull that off pretty masterfully.
Yeah. And in a way, this is something that you and I have talked from time to time about, Sam, in a way that's unique to the cinematic medium, but you can't do that in a, you know, you could use all kinds of words in a book, for example, you could make a painting, I suppose, but the images and the sound that goes along with the images, as well as the color and all that, that conveys in a way that no other medium really can. So I think that's a really key element of Bird as a director realizing how to do that.
And then when you later get Remy trying to teach Emil, his brother, about it, like, you see Emil go into that world, but he's not experiencing it in exactly the same way. It's a lighter version of it. He doesn't have the depth or the ability. And it's also something that slips through his fingers, where you realize you don't see Remy really go back to that in the movie, but you know, every time he's smelling or tasting, we now know Remy is entering into this zone that not all of us maybe can understand to the degree he does, but that device is set up so we can understand, like, what is it? I mean, it's another take on, like, a point of view shot, right? Well, this is like what it is to take on the point of view of Remy's palate.
Well, yeah, but and that's an interesting point, Sam, because that's another limitation that the film doesn't really dwell on, right? Just as not all of us can cook the way Remy can cook, the fact is not all of us have that palate. And so, you know, Emil is, to a certain degree, he is simply, he's not just limited by being a rat. He's limited by his physical equipment in the same way that I'm limited. When I have a meal with my wife, it is quite clear that she has a more sensitive palate, and she's responding to things in the food that either I don't detect or I couldn't care less about. So I think there's a sense in which I'm not sure. Okay, this is why Anton Ego is so important, right? Because not everybody can respond to the great chef's food in the way that the great chef experiences it when he or she makes it. So you know, there's a sense in which not everybody can be a great cook, and not everybody can be a great eater either. You know, there are people, you know, that are called the super tasters, right? That their palates are so sensitive they can actually detect things that none of us can possibly experience. And so we're all kind of, you know, despite what I said at the beginning about, you know, kind of overcoming biology, there are reminders that we are all, to a certain degree, limited by our biology. And so sometimes it's a matter of recognizing that and working within whatever band you have, or if you're like Remy, you have an extraordinary ability, you know, using that to the best of your ability.
The other movie I thought a lot about while watching this, and I think I brought this up, I don't remember what episode I brought this up on, but I thought a lot about Milos Forman's Amadeus, because I'm somebody who, like, listening to Mozart, but, like, I don't understand it. But when I watch Salieri listen, or even better, when he's just flipping through the sheet music, and you realize, like, oh, this is somebody who he's the only person in this world who really understands what he's encountering. And Forman is able to do that with sound and some visuals in really cool ways. That's what this reminds me of, is like, oh, they could give me a peek into the world of what it must be like to actually understand Mozart. This movie gives me a peek into like, what must somebody who is a great chef, who has a great palate, like when they take a bite of cheese, they're not thinking this is good. They're thinking, okay, here's some stuff going on here, and they're connecting it to other things. So it gives you this glimpse. And I was trying to think of other movies that do that. And that's my best example I could think of, as something where I was able to get sort of the point of view of somebody who can understand something at a level that I can't.
Yeah. And of course, you know, and then the question becomes, you know, what do you do with that insight? And of course, mm-hmm. it drives Salieri angry, you know, drives him into anger and revenge because he doesn't have the gift that Mozart has, as opposed to saying, this is wonderful. Look at the gift God's given the world.
Yes, yes. Well, and what's interesting is, you know, when Ego comes into the restaurant at the end, you're not sure what his, like, is his relationship going to be combative to the point where, like, can he be won over by this? And this is the third version of somebody experiencing food. And what I love is we don't get Ego going into like a Remy state. Well, because they could do that. They could say, we have created this visual language, this sonic language of what it looks like to, or what the experience of eating this food is like for people who really know. So that could show Remy and Ego to be like, oh, they are in a similar vein. They're experiencing this in a similar way. But instead, the brilliance of this movie is we get a like this Proustian memory instead, yes. Where it touches his tongue, and all of the sudden, and it's so perfectly done because like the sound drops out, and all of a sudden you have, you know, the child Anton Ego coming home from school or play, kind of roughed up and tired, and his mother putting a bowl of ratatouille in front of him, and it's like that's where this movie just levels up six times, and you realize like we are experiencing something really special here. But it is a different way to think about relationship to food and art, because it is something that's not just about the pure components of it, but it's also about how it moves us in a kind of emotional way, attached maybe to our personal histories, our experiences, our traumas, anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's why that scene is so effective and in some ways ironic, right? Because you have this critic who's been built up as elitist in his taste, and his response to the food is one of the most basic primal human responses, right? We all can think about that. I mean, I can tell you, you know, if you give me this lasagna, you know, you will take me right back to my childhood when my mom made lasagna every Saturday night or whatever. So we all know what that's like to respond to food. And it's not just the taste, right? It's the smell. There's everything about that takes us back to a different place in our period of our lives. And so that to me is one of the miracles of how the film takes that character of Anton, who, I suspect the man is so desperately thin because he can't find any food he really likes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's like his standards are so exacting. He's almost like Kafka's hunger artist. You know, he just can't find anything that actually he wants to eat. And Remy, in a sense, kind of rescues him from that. There's this whole riff in this film as to what is food, right? And here you see food as something all like restorative, almost magical. So it begins with Remy's dad saying, food is fuel. Shut up and eat your garbage. I actually have a friend who went to the doctor struggling with weight, and the doctor was saying, said that very thing to my friend, said that food is fuel. Your problem is you think of food as being something that's pleasurable. It's just fuel. You just eat as much fuel as you need. And then you've got Skinner, who's kind of bastardized food into a profitable commodity. Mm-hmm. Right? Food is whatever you can get people to buy, however you market it. And then you get Remy trying to educate Emile into enjoying food kind of the way a foodie does. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that's part of the problem, trying to get Emile to transcend what his palate's capable of. And then you get to Anton Ego, where food is memory. You know, food is comfort, ultimately. And that's why food is important to people.
So what I love about this movie, and this is one of my takeaways, because I want to get into Ego a little bit more here, because to me, this is the thing that makes this movie so brilliant. I remember watching this with my kids, and the first couple times I watched it, because I don't think I was watching it closely, it was on and we were, you know, with my little kids, and I remember thinking like, oh, it feels like there is a simpler version of this movie embedded into it, a simpler and lesser version of this movie embedded into it, where the climax of the movie is the chase through Paris on the boats for the letter and the will. And then it ends with Skinner kind of being cast aside and Linguini inheriting the restaurant. It's like that's like the maybe the old school 80-minute version of this as a kid's movie, right? Like, because it has a climax and it has the success and you see them, you know, toasting and the restaurant is going. It's like you could just have that movie and it would be fine. But I forgot that the movie opens with Ego. He's part of, in my head it was like, well, he's just this thing at the end, but it actually opens with him in that cold open. You see Ego and you hear from him, you hear him critical of this notion of anyone can cook, and then he becomes the piece at the end of the movie. So it's like he takes that simpler, lesser movie and wraps around it this story about Ego, this story about criticism, this story to make it, it's like to make it even more a movie about art. In case you missed that this was a movie about art, that's where this where what he does with that. And then the fact that he ends this movie with an extended piece of criticism. You know, like it's not just, oh, the review was great, but like this movie is about getting to that. I mean, functionally, we get what seems like basically a full review just read aloud. That is, to me, such an amazing part of this movie that I want to talk about. But before we get to what he writes about, I also love the images that we get along with it. I think I can get so caught up in like what Ego is saying that I went back and watched it without the sound because I wanted to look at what was shown during that. And I love that it is kind of what we were talking about with Babette drinking the wine, that you get, you know, after Ego leaves, you get everybody leaving the restaurant and everybody kind of goes their separate ways. And I love that you see separately Remy, Linguini, and Colette all in bed and none of them can sleep. And they're not restless because I think they're worried about the review. I think it is that feeling of like when you, if you've ever been part of something that turned out to be really great or really important, there is just this sense of I don't know, for me, the sense of like being alive in a kind of way that you couldn't want to sleep. All you want to do is just sort of sit in that moment. And so we're seeing them all awake in bed. And then we see Remy, much like Babette, sort of sitting and watching Paris at night turn into Paris in the morning. And he even says like, it was the happiest night of my life, right? It was like, I had done this thing, and they don't know the review yet. They just know like good or bad, like we have, like we have done this, you know, give me leave to do my utmost. And we have done that. I love the visuals of that before we even get into what Ego says.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing about what happens with Ego is it's kind of rediscovering why he became a critic. You know, I wanted us to watch this movie in part because I said I'd been reading A.O. Scott's book, and Scott kind of concludes the book with an extended conversation with himself about this film and about the role of Anton Ego. And one of the theses or one of the themes of Scott's book is that critics are in their own right artists, and artists are a kind of critic. And so he spends a lot of time, rather than seeing these as impulses that are warring with each other, they're actually in concert with each other. And I think that's why he finds the character of Anton Ego so interesting, because it turns out that early on, Ego sets up two metaphors to kind of suggest that he and Remy are at odds. When he first comes in and meets Linguini before he knows his opponent is Remy, he says, "You've been playing this game without an opponent. You know, you haven't been playing the game right." And then when he's asked what he wants to eat when he comes to the restaurant, he says, "Hit me with your best shot." So you know, both of those scenes set up this idea like it's critic versus artist. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you discover at the end that Anton Ego remembers at the end is, no, I didn't get into this to tear the artist down. I went into this to appreciate what the artist is doing. And so that's why losing his job as a critic is actually the best thing that happens to him, because it reunites him with what his actual love is. And so that's kind of the point of that Scott is making, that the critic and the artist ultimately kiss because they are in some sense one in the same. And so that seems like a very satisfying conclusion, because it takes this, you know, it takes this opening where the critic's almost been blamed for Gusteau's death. And it kind of redeems it at the end.
Yeah, I thought a lot about in that book, Better Living Through Criticism. Scott talks about this. One of my favorite parts of that book, he talks about this poem by Rilke about an ancient statue at the Louvre of the torso of Apollo. And he breaks down this poem, and he talks about, to your point, that the poem is both criticism and art. Like, it is the poem itself is art, but what it's doing is talking about this other piece of art. So it is criticism as this potentially loving conversation, and thoughtful conversation between the original piece, the person experiencing the piece, and the person experiencing the criticism of the piece. That as the reader, you're also drawn into that conversation, and you're drawn to, you know, potentially want to go to this restaurant and experience this. The other thing that I love about what Ego writes about is, you know, he first talks about like how the critic is, the role of the critic can be very easy and very fun. He says it's fun to read, or to write and to read negative criticism. But he also is like, but ultimately I also know that it's not important, that the most average piece of junk is going to be more long lasting and important than the thing that I write describes it as an average piece of junk. But then he says, like, there are times when the critic also takes risks, which made me think of Gusteau talking about cooking, right? That cooking isn't about following the recipe. It's about being fearless and taking a risk. And Ego, I mean, that's one of the first things you hear Gusteau say. And at the end of the movie, you hear Ego say, criticism is that too, that it's fun and easy to write negative criticism, but sometimes you encounter the sublime. And you encounter the new, and that the new needs friends, and the critic sometimes has to step out because the world is harsh to, is potentially harsh to the new. So that's exactly what Ego does, right? That he, by writing this, he also ends his career, you know, because that's what I love. Is I also love the like ticking time bomb of Skinner and the health inspector, where, you know, Remy says like, well, of course we couldn't leave them in the, you know, in the meat locker forever. So like this is going to end, but it's like they were able to hit pause and let this one magical night happen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then have that. And then it, of course, this concludes with Ego, kind of finally interpreting Gusteau's "anyone can cook" is like, it doesn't mean anyone can be a great chef, but a great chef can come from anywhere. And I mean, that is the big theme of this story, right? That the great artist can come from anywhere. Even Remy as a rat can be this.
And as a little grace note, Ego actually ends up profiting as well.
Yes.
So he doesn't need a line of frozen foods to make money to profit from the food. So.
Yes. Anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
Well, a couple more things. First of all, just a little side note. The effect that Remy has on Skinner as Skinner tries to, you know, prove that he exists, and it reminded me very much of Inspector Clouseau and Commissioner Dreyfus in the Pink Panther films, as you see, you know, Skinner kind of being driven into a kind of madness. The other thing I wanted to point out is the film also has some incredibly well executed kind of hyperkinetic scenes, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you get the rats going through the riding through the sewer, and then after Remy gets there exploring Paris, running through the kitchen, running motorcycles in the street, when he's being chased, when he has the documents. I mean, those are, you know, in a sense, you could say they're kind of classic animated film set pieces, but they're just so well done. And it's so nicely a part of the pacing of the film. And I just want to end up with a couple things that A.O. Scott says. So I went back to A.O. Scott's original review of the film. And one of the things he points out that I loved A.O. Scott as a film critic, because he always thought of things that I thought, well, that's so smart. Why didn't I think of that? He points out that Remy's story is kind of the classic classic coming of age story you referred to earlier, Sam, of the young man from the provinces coming to seek his fortune. I just thought that was perfect. But the other thing he says about the film kind of gets back to what you were saying about, you know, how is this a Brad Bird film? He says, like The Incredibles, Mr. Bird's earlier film, Pat Ratatouille celebrates the passionate, sometimes aggressive pursuit of excellence, an impulse it exemplifies. I thought that's a really nice way of looking at the film. It's about an artist, but at the same time, it displays an artist in full pursuit of the excellent, of the best.
Another thing I love about this movie, as we're just kind of finishing things up here, I love the voice cast of this, because it's a great cast, and you know, like a lot of famous actors in this, but it's not stunt casting. Like, no. Patton Oswalt was not a big star at this time. And then so many of the other characters are American actors or English actors doing French accents that you wouldn't recognize Ian Holm as Skinner, or Will Arnett or Janine Garofalo, because they don't sound like themselves. Like I love the cast of this. And then we need to mention Peter O'Toole as Anton Ego. I love Peter O'Toole, and he is particularly great in this.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about the voiceover. I meant to say that earlier. I also meant to say my other connection to Barry Lyndon is we also have a narrator. Now, the narrator is also the main character. But one of the things that's interesting about the film is Remy does a lot of narration early on, and then it kind of drops out for a long time. It's really interesting. I'd have to watch the film again to kind of think about, you know, when is the narration there from Remy, when is it not? But I think it's a lot of it has to do with maybe – as narration does, maybe providing a little bit of information about what the character is thinking that you can't necessarily infer from the action. But I think it's used sparingly, but also quite effectively.
And finally, this movie comes out in 2007, which is one of the great movie years, definitely of this century. We've watched five. This is the fifth movie from 2007 we've watched. So we've watched No Country for Old Men, Ratatouille, Once, Lars and the Real Girl, and Persepolis all came out in 2007, along with the other Oscar nominees were There Will Be Blood, Michael Clayton, Juno, and Atonement. Zodiac also comes out in 2007. What a great year to go to the movies. I had a newborn, so I did not see a lot of movies in 2007 in the theaters, but a pretty good year.
Pretty good year.
So what do you have for us for next week, Barrett?
Well, I'm going to continue this theme of movies with food. And you earlier mentioned, Sam, as I was going to, if you hadn't, that we kicked this off very early on in the podcast with one of your favorite films, Bob Evans' Feast. So I want to go and kind of work my way backwards in time to 1996, to Stanley Tucci's Big Night, with Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub, and surprise, surprise, Ian Holm.
Oh, I have never heard of this movie, so I'm very excited. This has been a while since you picked something that I'm not even aware of, so I'm very excited for this. Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film, for having this conversation. This is a movie that I had seen many times, but it was fun to watch with this set of lenses, and I think I appreciate it on levels that I never did before. So thank you for that. That is all the time that we have. But we will be back next week to talk about Big Night in the video store.